Interview with Graham Jones in Raleigh, December
12th, 1973.
Yours ones work better than the ones at the White
House, I trust.
That's terrific. We
ought
to have a camera.
Did you read Art Buchwald's column last night? Is that the secret of that 18-minute hum?
Is that
it was Nixon humming for 18 minutes.
That he has two hums?
Two hums. One is reading the Washington Post, and one when he's reading his tax returns.
Right.
No, but in terms of governor and senator, that the leadership of the party kept race out of it by keeping candidates out who would clearly symbolize the race issue.
Of course, that was the big issue between Sanford and Beverly Lake in the 1960 primary. I think there's some credence in what you say.
Part of the question is this. He said that North Carolina was progressive and different from the rest of the South. Race relations were just different, better, all along more progressive. So one of the questions we're asking people was Key right or was Key wrong? That's the first question, and if he was based on one's answer to that, then how do you explain what has happened since? Has North Carolina changed, or is Key just wrong, or is that a...
Jack, can you not say that he was right at the time that he wrote his book, but that times changed and things changed, including... Of course, the Supreme Court decisions, and not only the South, including North Carolina, but the whole nation had a backswing. Goldwater was running with the hopes of capturing that, you know, and the backlash in 64, and it hadn't developed, but there was a hell of a lot around of it in 68, as evidenced, and again in 72, I think. So I would suggest that perhaps Key was right to the point he was writing. But then, well, Willie Smith, you know, beat Frank Graham in a racist campaign. And what happened between the first primary when Frank Graham lacked just 5,000 votes of a clear majority over Willie Smith and Bob Reynolds was the Supreme Court handed down its integration decision on public universities at the graduate level. That was their first decision on integration. And on repudiating the separate but equal thing, doctrine. So Key published what year?
48. 49.
Yeah. Sanford, to the best of my knowledge, Sanford was the first person elected in a statewide race, in a governor's race in a southern state, after the Little Rock conflict, when Eisenhower sent the troops out, and Orville Faubus began to make his name with the rednecks, given a candidate staunchly for segregation, you know, at any cost, and one who was soft on integration, soft on segregation. He was the first one, I believe, to be elected in a southern state after those Supreme Court decisions began to come. You checked me on that.
But he still ran as a sort of a, at least paying lip service to segregation.
Yeah. Some of the supporters of Dr. Lake said after he became governor, he'd said during the campaign, and I think about the meanest statement he made that would be calculated to entice the segregationists was, well, I know how to handle NAACP. And Dr. Lake supporters after the campaign, after he was in office, said, yeah, he's appointing them all to state policy boards. But I don't think, in the general public mind, I don't think there was any question. Dr. Lake was the segregationist. Sanford wasn't running around saying, we want your daughter to marry a black man, that sort of thing. But he was saying such things, you remember, Jack, as all what we need to do is improve the schools, not close them. Dr. Lake was saying, you know, if we have to, let's do what Prince Edward County, Virginia did. Let's close the schools before we let them mix those pickaninnies. Well, of course, Dr. Lake wasn't using language like that, but that was how it was understood, before they mix the black children with your children.
We're trying, you know, this whole period, Sanford has played such a... Were you involved in Carr Scott's campaign?
Just as a voter and active in the Young Democrats at Chapel Hill. When he ran for the Senate and when Sanford was managing his campaign, of course, he had run in 48 and had upset the remnants of the old Max Garden machine when he won the governor's race. So not directly, no, not in the office.
But Sanford, because he did manage that campaign, then he went to the state senate, right?
No, Sanford was in career was roughly president of YDC in 1949, then to the state senate from Cumberland County, and then Carr Scott asked him to manage his campaign for the Senate against Alton Lennon in 54. By the way, Lennon tried to use some race against Carr Scott. He had this phony ad in the Winston-Salem Journal that Sanford exposed, I think, the day it was published, signed ostensibly by black leaders in Winston-Salem, saying, this is our candidate, Carr Scott, you know, for the black people, so let's all go out and elect him. The Lennon people have put that in. So race was at least partially a factor, to some extent a factor in the 54 race that Carr Scott defeated. So Sanford managed Scott's campaign in 54, and he and Henry Jordan and some others put up a balloon to run against Luther Hodges in 56 and very wisely pulled it in, then ran in 60 for governor.
Well, we're trying to do in part in picking the North Carolina chapter, though, feel that Sanford drove Sanford's administration as a major force almost in North Carolina politics in the last quarter century, and the effect is still felt. And trying to evaluate both the strengths and weaknesses of his administration, and what distinguished it from others, and assessing it is different because you get to talk to people and you get a wide variety of views. And you were inside. How do you assess both his administration and the impact it's had on North Carolina politics?
It was progressive, and on two specific issues, liberal on the race question and on the education issue, which aren't necessarily distinguishable, are they? He was a free spender by North Carolina standards, certainly. He was highly innovative in education from, as he kept saying, from the first grade through the graduate school. And these efforts like the School of the Arts and the Advancement School and Learning Institute in North Carolina, as you know, were all established under his aegis.
When he went into office, did he have in mind to establish these sort of things, or did they develop after he got into office?
The innovations, no. The big thrust was on public education, pure and simple, more money. And, of course, that led to this thing he called a quality education program, which got down to the basics of giving the teachers a living salary. And that's still going, by the way. That sales tax on food was enacted to get the money to do that. And that he committed himself to, that he did. Surprised the hell of it all. A lot of people think he did what he said he was going to do. The innovations on things like the School of the Arts and the Advancement School, the Governor's School in Winston-Salem, and the Learning Institute, they all came after, well into his administration. So the big thrust was, okay, we need more money. The number one job of the state government, which is education, Then, of course, he had the Higher Education Act of 1963, which in effect established this very comprehensive community college system across the state.
Wasn't there a defeat of a major bond issue on higher education?
It was not only on higher education. It included a building for the archives and history. It included some buildings for the Department of Agriculture. Yeah, there was. I think Hugh Cannon would tell you the same thing. It was a 60-some million-dollar thing in 1961. It came in the fall after this unpopular tax on food and other things had been levied in the spring to pay for the quality education program. The decision was made that this should be soft-soled and shouldn't go out and rake up a lot of snakes. So it was soft-soled, and the snakes came out and voted. The good guys, they didn't show at the polls, so it was defeated. By the same token, there was another two referendums during that four-year administration. One was on the court reform in 62 that was passed overwhelmingly. That was hard sold. And then one on a $200 million public school bond issue, which was hard sold in 64. And that passed, I think, 99 out of the 100 counties. So, yes, there was a bond issue beat, and I think it was correctly assessed as being a slap at Sanford.
Was his administration in that 25-year period from 1948 through 74 a unique kind of a thing to follow any other pattern, other administrations like it?
I don't know how truly unique you can call it, Walter. You know, the story on Aycock preaching education at the turn of the century, turning his red shirt segregationist campaign that he was running in into a crusade for education. Carr Scott was in that progressive populist, if you will, bill. Certainly Sanford picked up the morale and the public reputation of education tremendously during his 4 years. He continued, as you know, what Luther Hodges had put so much emphasis on, new industry. You know, you get a bigger tax base and you have more tax money to spend for education. You also have somewhere for people who are coming off the farm in great numbers to go to work and still stay in North Carolina. Scott was a Jacksonian. Carr Scott was a Jacksonian type Democrat and made tremendous advances. Of course, his emphasis was on highways, getting the farmer out of the mud. And so you've got at least two, by North Carolina standards, liberal Democrats. And that doesn't mean the others are reactionary.
Between
48 and 7. Yeah.
Simpson, how would you compare Moore's administration?
Maybe not the best judge of it, but it seemed to me it was a standstill. A good, safe, solid, and not rattling in.
How about Scott?
Bob Scott, you're speaking of now. I can't see that we made, you know, that much advance under Bob Scott. He
so what
was not, maybe I'm comparing him with the wrong man, comparing him with his father. You know, his father was a hell-raising, let's get on with it, and he'd take on the prize. But again, I may not be fair to Bob, but because I am comparing it with his father, but I can't think of any great advance the state made. Well, maybe this is because of the different times that they were governor, his dad and himself.
But you're saying in the last 13 years, the only period where there was some real change, real progressivism, or movement in state government was in the Sanford administration. The rest of the period after that was sort of a standstill, kind of leveling off.
It seems that way to one person. Yeah.
Yeah. Why? Did Sanford make that many changes that the state was ready for that kind of a...
Yeah, the state was ready, obviously, and yes, I think he did. And
just their reaction to the Sanders administration that caused, you know, we disagreed about the Sanders winning the party, and these people haven't done all that well since. Are people who are normally associated with his governmental philosophy prior in the governor's race, following him, Galifianakis last year, Bowles last year.
Yeah. I couldn't buy that premise completely because Rich Pryor's in the U.S. Congress and Charlie Rose is in the U.S. Congress. Certainly to some extent it's true. Walter, I don't know. They keep telling me that North Carolina basically is a conservative state. I've never seen it that way, but it sure in hell votes conservative when you get the race thing tied into it frequently. And it sure in heck, the prior state, as you well know, resides in some banks and utility companies, the continuing power. You can get a Carr Scott or a Terry Sanford to come by and win and make these big changes. Of course, I don't mean to imply it. That Terry Sanford was any radical liberal. He was not. Some of his best friends gave him a lot of hell about his appointments to the Utilities Commission, for example. They were pro-utility company, to say the least. But he was progressive in the race, certainly in the race picture and in the education picture.
You said the appointment for pro-utility company.
Yeah, he reappointed a gentleman named Worthington, who I don't think ever voted against a utility lawyer the whole time he was on that commission. He caught a lot of hell from his liberal constituency, Sanford did, when he made those points.
But one of the ways you judge an administration is not just by what it did while it was in office, but what happened after it left office.
Right.
But then the comparisons are invariably made between the three administrations that follow that, including now Holzhauser and Sanford. That's the first thing. The second thing is, of the people associated with Sanford, did they end up in fairly powerful positions both within and outside of the government?
Yeah, there are what? At least a dozen or so members of the General Assembly now who were Sanford people in the 1960 campaigns. I mentioned, of course, Richardson Pryor is in the Congress. Charlie Rose is from representing the 7th District in the Congress. They have done very well. Some of them have been beaten, of course. Well, Rich Pryor was beaten, of course, when he ran for governor, just as Skipper was. Others have been defeated who have run. The Commissioner of Insurance, Johnny Ingram, was a Sanford man in 1960.
But why is it, Ben, we keep hearing, you come from outside the state into North Carolina, and you hear about the Sanford machine, and he's a Sanford man. You don't hear about, Scott people or more people. I mean, what was there about that administration that produces this kind of, maybe it's not a kinship, but relationship among everybody who was involved in that campaign and the administration? Or are we overstating it?
Well, I think, number one, there was an identifiable Carr Scott group. The branch head boys, who included a hell of a lot of boys from the cities as well as from the rural precincts.
I'm talking about Bob Scott.
Oh, I'm sorry. He put together what amounted to a mini Roosevelt coalition. You know, he had Sanford had people like Millard Barbie, the president of State F of LCIO. He had Charlie Cannon, who was maybe the most anti-union textile leader in an industry that's notably anti-union.
Why was he supporting Sanford?
Well, I say Sanford wasn't a radical lib, as Charlie Cannon knew, and I doubt that bothered Mr. Cannon's conservatism a bit that Sanford wanted to raise money for public education. And, of course, to Mr. Cannon's economic interest, the race question probably didn't amount to hell of beans, except where he might use it.
People say he's a Sanford man. What does that mean to you? Someone says somebody is a Sanford man in North Carolina. What does that mean? What is a Sanford man?
Well, of course, someone who would have participated in those campaigns in the gubernatorial primaries in 1960 and for Jack Kennedy in the summer and fall of 60. Of course, a lot of Sanford men in 1960, or some Sanford people, including people he had appointed to various boards and agencies, were Dan Moore people in 64. So I don't know that coalition has ever, meaning the broad structure of it, has ever been put back together. The Sanford people included a lot of people who supported Bob Scott early when he began to run for governor in 68, and it included some people who didn't think a damn of Bob Scott. The Sanford Coalition included this old Branchhead crew from Carscott days that Sanford had gotten to know, of course, during the 1954 senatorial campaign when he managed Carscott's campaign. So a Sanford man was somebody who's, if you want my definition, somebody who supported Terry Sanford in 1960. I'm not sure how much it's been put back together since that time. It sure in hell worked in 1960 in three very difficult campaigns.
Yeah, but you see, the thing that strikes us is that that's 1960. That's almost 14 years ago, okay? I would guess that in a few years, unless Bowles runs again, you won't hear about the Bowles win, but you'll still be hearing about the Sanford wing of the party. Though this is some kind of almost indestructible kind of thing that's been around so long that people are identified with it, that it means something in terms of philosophy, not just party machinery. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
But I'm trying to see how you would get the Charlie Cannons, to use one example, and the Millard Barbies in the same philosophical wing. Obviously, they never were. But they saw Sanford was broad enough in his appeal that he could attract those people. And he attracted, as you know, the black vote in 1960, and he attracted, as you've already suggested, a hell of a lot of segregationist vote from his activities either Carolina when he was a student in that Depression, post-Depression era, or in the American Legion, or in the bar among lawyers, or in the Methodist Church.
What kind of people did he surround himself with when he was governor?
Gibson Prather, you know him. He was the managing editor, or editor, I guess, for years of the Federal Observer. He told, printed something that he was going to send a supply of milk to the governor's office every morning after Sanford went into the Capitol because everybody on his staff was so damn young. Well, of course, Kennedy and others have changed that since, but I was the oldest man, I guess, working for him. I was 31 when he went into office, 32, 33 something. Hugh Cannon was less than 30, and Tom Lambeth was less than 30. Joel Fleischman was less than 30. So he had a lot of young people around him.
Did he see creative kind of people?
Yeah, he thrived on people bashing heads with one another in his presence, arguing over things. Yeah, he liked the conflict of ideas.
Is it fair to say?
And I think deliberately saw him out.
Is it fair to say that since that time you haven't had that in the executive office, including today?
I couldn't judge. I haven't been down there. I honestly could not judge.
Have you seen anything to suggest that there has been?
Well, that's the sort of thing, you know, you don't see even in the dome and the NNO. This sort of thing that takes place behind closed doors, customarily.
Was this one of the distinguishing features of the Sanford administration?
I think you're right, yes. I think that's so. Which would jive with this broad coalition that he'd put together for his election in the first place.
Yeah. But he didn't have any. Did he have any? Yes. Or did he have anybody on the staff, say, representing the conservative interest?
There was no conservative, to my knowledge, on his staff. Now, how would you label Skipper Bowles? Certainly, Skipper was one of his closest, if not the closest, single advisor throughout those 4 years as governor. As you know, Skipper was director of C&D and then took his dollar year of chairmanship of C&D. But he
he'd
been a classmate with Sanford over at, or was at Chapel Hill at the same time Sanford was, and was a very effective money raiser, to put it very bluntly, for Sanford in the 60. And so was he conservative? Is he conservative or liberal or somewhere in between? I don't know how you label.
I would think he'd be to the left of Charlie Cabot.
Jack is asking, did he have an identifiable in-house conservative that everybody can say, yeah, there he is. He represents our...
He got a lot of conservative advice, because that's the way to... power structure of North Carolina is set up, you know, from people at Wachovia Bank, put it very bluntly, from people at Reynolds Tobacco Company, from the textile enters.
Duke Power.
I'm trying to think.
Duke Power, CP&L being that same
group. Sure.
And is that group still the dominant force in the state?
On a continuing basis. Now, you know, you can go out and raise money for one hefty campaign. I guess the McGovern people raise some that way, but on a continuing basis, those companies have interest that, you know, they're going to spend some money to protect year in and year out. They've been around a hell of a long time.
Are they more or less the controlling force in the legislature? I mean, are you not going to get legislation approved if they really oppose it, are you?
It can be done, but it's a difficult thing.
Would that be part of the reasons that you'd go for putting a sales tax on food, because to get the kind of money you need for those kind of programs, you're going to have some sort of tax structure that's acceptable to the power structure.
I think that's fair. There was a lobbyist from one of the utility companies, and you don't need his name, but he came in and very earnestly told me one morning and said his company had told him to spend the rest of the legislature with nothing else to do but pass that quality education program, which, of course, was tied to the sales tax. Yeah, your answer is yes.
Graham, can you...
Of course, let me back off just a minute. You couldn't have passed a corporation income tax increase. You couldn't have passed a tobacco tax in 1961 with a lawyer city governor like Sanford. Now, Bob Scott, being a farmer and past master of state grains, could and did pass a tobacco tax 8 years later. 5 years later.
Wouldn't that be one of the outstanding aspects of Bob Scott's administration?
Yeah, that is
a real breakthrough for North Carolina.
That is a big plus that he achieved and took it on a chin, about as much as Sanford did on the food tax.
How about on the... let me just ask one more question. We're talking about Scott's administration. How significant, from your perspective, was the reorganization of higher education in North Carolina?
I think it's worked out well. How well, we'll know after this 1974 General Assembly. If the legislature starts building medical schools, then it's not worth the paper it was printed on if they leave it to the Board of Governors to determine such things, and it will have been a very great step forward.
I mean, am I correct that in essence what he did, and I base my question more on my familiarity with the South Carolina situation and some knowledge of the similarities, was it not, did he not create a structure that in effect at least was designed and if successful will bring order out of chaos?
Yeah. And I said, of course, the proof of the pudding will come in this 74 General Assembly when they decide whether they will or will not build a medical school at East Carolina. That's the crux of it. You know, that Higher Education Act of 63 that Sanford passed was designed to do the same sort of thing. Well, of course, hell, it lasted until everybody wanted to name the teachers' colleges and all the other schools in the state universities. And that, in effect, it was negated by that subsequent legislative.
Weren't some allegations along about that time Sanford was sort of playing a backroom role in getting those universities established?
Yeah, he was charged with that. And of course, he had as you well know, he had a bullion up to run against Sam Irwin, and he was making peace with the Beverly Lake people, who included, of course, Bob Morgan, who happened to be chairman of the Board of Trustees of East Carolina. So yes.
We go back to
you should ask Governor Sanford that question. You knew what the answer was anyhow.
We didn't ask him, did we?
No, I forgot about it.
Can we get back to the Sanford machine, the festival? You know, the assumption was that somehow you push a button, and then this machine goes into operation all over the state and can elect the people that it wants to. Along comes 1972, when, in essence, a favorite son, past ex-governor, is not only defeated in a primary, but clobbered. And if, given what usually happens in the course of time, that the further you're removed from a man's administration, the better he looks, how do you go about it? First of all, is there such a thing as a machine that could be mobilized? And secondly, what happened in 72 to the machine?
Now, you're saying what happened to the machine in 72. Whom do you identify? Which candidate?
The so-called Sanford machine.
Which candidate in 72 were you identifying? With Skipper or?
No, I'm talking about the presidential primary.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think results you cite maybe indicate the answer. It was not a deliverable vote. He got, 750,000 votes in the fall election of 1960, but nobody in North Carolina or even Jersey City anymore can push a button and deliver votes like that. You have, what's the Sanford machine? The machine's, 100 county managers and maybe 15, 20 other people, along with Bert Bennett and people like Skipper. And so, as I said, those people started splitting in 1964. Some of them went with Dan Moore for governor. They'd got miffed about something. So I think maybe if there was that thought, it was an exaggerated thought about what could be delivered any time after 1960. It was a loose coalition right in the office. There were these people, well, Ben Roney and Roy, I think of his last name in a minute. Anyhow, there were some Cora Scott Branchhead types, you know, who had been working for Sanford from the time Cora Scott had died in Washington. On the one hand, you had this young J.C. type, progressive business man type like Bert Bennett and Skipper Bowles. And there was some clashes of personalities even during the campaigns in '60. Inside the campaign headquarters. I'm sure this has never happened in any other campaign headquarters job, but you had different, certainly personality conflicts, if not conflicts of ideology. I think they're more personality, you know, than anything else.
How much?
So to get back to it, I don't think there was ever a Sanford machine in the sense that Boss Haig or Boss Crump or somebody could deliver votes. You just couldn't do it. It wasn't even done. Well, there were some votes, of course, delivered for Richardson Pryor. Perhaps Judge Pryor wouldn't have had as many as he did, which wasn't nearly enough to beat Dan Moore. But there weren't enough votes among those 700 or so thousand elected Sanford that you could deliver. Some small, much smaller fraction of those votes maybe could be delivered by this group of 100 county managers. And
if you can't deliver votes, can the so-called machine or Sanford wing deliver party leaders? In other words, there may be a difference.
Yeah, I think it already has. I keep falling back on Rich Pryor and people like Johnny Ingram, Commissioner of Insurance, people like Charlie Rose, the congressman from the 7th District. A lot of leaders have been produced out of that wing.
So how much did Sanford hurt himself getting into the presidential primary?
Quite a bit. On top of the primaries that revolved around the race question, then you added this religious question, you know. That's a double whammy. We had some friends at the Baptist State Convention who had...
Excuse me, what is the religious question?
He endorsed Jack Kennedy, a Catholic.
Oh, no, okay. I'm sorry.
I'm talking more about the 72 primary.
And where does religion come?
No, my question was how much did he hurt himself getting into the presidential primary in 72? You keep hearing that a lot of people advised him not to do it.
Well, a lot of his friends, you know, thought he started floating a balloon about when Muskie was still viable. A lot of his friends thought this was, you know, this... wouldn't go. I'm glad, in retrospect, that he ran in North Carolina, even though Wallace beat him. You know, there were this many delegates that did not vote for George Wallace from North Carolina. That's my prejudice against bigots, I guess, Jack. Even though Sanford had to take it on the chin, I'm glad he ultimately ended up being in that race so that Wallace wouldn't have the whole... Well, thank you. But how bad did he hurt himself? I have no idea, you know.
How did he hurt himself? Better question.
I don't think anybody in the Democratic Party, nationally or in the state, can look back on 72 and say, you did something wrong. 72 was a disaster.
Well,
I was thinking more
within the context of the North Carolina Democratic Party, which, of course, had primaries going on, and so with Sanford entering the primary perceived as an unwise thing to do from the party standpoint.
Particularly now that you don't have Democrats don't have a governor in office, and no really recognized party leader as such. There's party leaders, but no one leader.
And to some extent, I guess, with Sanford entering the primary, did it have any effect on voter perception, I suppose, giving particularly in eastern North Carolina, well, eastern North Carolina, Piedmont voters, too, a feel that the North Carolina Democratic Party was opposed to George Wallace, that maybe carried on into the fall and helped worked against the Democratic Party candidates who were looking for a broader base.
That could be. To tell you the truth, it had not occurred to me. Of course, and again, I don't know, in this business you gentlemen are talking about, it's hard to measure it like these physicists measure things, you know, on computers or in a slide rule or a test tube. But Sanford and Kennedy carried the eastern 40 counties of North Carolina overwhelmingly in 1960. The counties, the Wallace counties and the Beverly Lake counties, the counties that
traditional Democratic counties.
Yeah. Of course, we had a saying then that what the eastern North Carolina farmers decided was that they feared Ezra Taft Benson a lot more than they did the boat in Rome. As you know, Hoover carried this state. He was the only Republican between them. The end of Reconstruction and Nixon in 68.
I haven't really had to look back on that 64 election, but did Goldwater run particularly strong in the eastern counties?
Johnson carried this state heavily, very heavily.
He carried heavily. North Carolina too, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, Johnson, he carried my precinct. It was about two-thirds Republican. He carried, didn't he carry some of the high Piedmont counties? As I recall, he carried some Mecklenburg types, if not Mecklenburg itself. In 60, Kennedy and Sanford lost these counties like Forsyth and Guilford and so on. In fact, Guilford voted 66% for Nixon and Gavin in 1960.
If Sanford is going to be a power in the Democratic National Party or a serious candidate for president in 76, don't you think what happened in 72 in the primary myriad hurt him in this state in terms of the people, the leaders and so on who used to identify with him? What I'm trying to get at, you think that primary decision to run and then be defeated and then go on to the convention, the role that he played, may have hurt him in this state among people who used to identified with him?
You're asking if he's getting like Harold Stassen, and there's been...
Some people have suggested that.
And I can't give you any categorical yes or no, but I would suspect you're right, yes.
Grim, can you tell us a little bit just what is and was, or sort of what was and is Burke Bennett's role in North Carolina? We're going to talk to him next week, and all I know is every time we ask somebody who should you talk to in North Carolina politics to really understand what's going on, one of the first three names that come up is his. And yet I don't know a whole heck of a lot about his role, and we are going to talk to him.
Burke's real, as you do know already, he's a real highly intelligent, real hardworking, oil dealer. His daddy was in politics, and primarily for Scythe County prior to birth. And I'm told he helped run the political side of Scythe County for some years. I'm sure Bert got some of that from him. Bert, if he has any shortcomings, it might have been that he was born with a silver spoon, which has a lot of assets attached to it and also has some deficits in politics, as you would know. I guess is a legitimate criticism, but Bert, and this was said somewhat, as you know, Walter, of Skipper, that they ought to forget those Republicans in the country clubs and go all night among their people. Skipper probably did, as a matter of fact. But when Bert got beat, you know, when he ran for the state senate in 1966, they said, well, if you get out of Forsyth Country Club and get out among people who are his natural constituency.
Now, was he in the Senate before then?
That was the first, and so far as I know, the only time he's ever run for public office. He wasn't opposed in the primary in Forsyth, but the Republicans beat him in the fall. Of course, 66, again, was a bad year for Democrats.
What was and is the source of his power if he doesn't hold elective office?
Well, his having managed Sanford's campaign for governor, certainly.
But solely that?
And I have to say, this nebulous thing of personality. He's one hell of a nice guy. People like him. Even when they don't agree with him, they usually like him.
What was his role in the Stamp administration? I mean, did
he was chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee. And
was he a close advisor? Did he actually?
Oh yes. He
policy decisions.
He and Skipper again, and a few others, Van Roney and Cleta, helped deal the patronage out. You know, when the patronage was dealt out. I don't think Bert ever. In fact, I know damn well he never thought that he told Sanford what to do. In fact, he said at several meetings, you know, when they'd get the old crew back together during those years and afterwards, that God knows Sanford had told him no often enough. But certainly Bert was influential. And
how about since then?
I can't assess it because certainly they're great friends.
I mean, has he been active in campaigns since then?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. But to the extent you ask Bert, he's believe it or not, he'll give you a straight answer. Or he'll tell you he's not going to answer your question.
I'm just, you know, I didn't realize he had run for the Senate. Because then we got to do it. That's just
yeah,
good there, to know when you go talk to him that you don't.
There was a Republican.
Well, that's interesting. In that, having been in politics all these years, and when he tries it himself, he goes down the tube. I mean, that's bound to have some impact.
66 was a bad year for Scythe County. He elected a whole solid slate of Republicans.
Did Ham Horton beat him?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. But I honestly can't tell you. There were two, as I recall, maybe two Senate seats up, and the Republicans won both of them from Forsyth.
'66 was sort of a big Republican year southwide.
Nationwide.
This is a remarkable thing about Rich Pryor. Now, he beat a guy that I know Sanford and a lot of us thought was the smartest Republican in North Carolina, Bill Osteen. Rich Pryor beat Bill Osteen. No, this was 68, excuse me, 68 that Rich Pryor beat Osteen, wasn't it? Dag Carnegie had held that congressional seat and retired, and Rich got the nomination without any real opposition, as I remember. And in the 6th District of North Carolina, which is Alamance and Guilford and a couple other counties that tend to be Republican, Rich Pryor won. That's an amazing feat.
What happened probably, I know it happened big in South Carolina, was the Wallace people were voting Democratic in local and state races. Republicans lost two-thirds of the legislative seats in South Carolina in 68 when Nixon carried the state.
But they had three and they lost two?
No, they had like 25 and lost 14.
Are there any other major changes that have occurred in the state from 1948 through 74 that strike you? Not just political, but social and economic change.
I was about to say, of course, the main thing is it's become highly respectable to vote Republican. I know a guy down in one of the eastern counties, Walter Cole, is doing the fall election of 16. He said, God damn, he said, they've got a Republican billboard out here on the highway. It's the first time that guy ever seen a Republican billboard in eastern North Carolina. It shook him up. That's the sort of thing that wasn't done, you know. Oh, gosh, you asking me. The state has continued, of course, to industrialize. The state has continued to lose its family farm, which Governor Sanford and Skip Bowles and I suppose everybody.